ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Happy New Year's Eve. I hope you've got big plans tonight to ring in 2026 with your loved ones, or maybe you're planning a low-key celebration. Wherever you're tuning in from, I'm grateful that you're choosing to spend a little bit of your time with me. And if this new year involves travel for you, I've got just the stories you want to hear. Coming up, discussing the big things that emerge on a road trip. Not the big things in life, but the big things on the side of the highway. Maybe you're passing one right now. The big mango, the big prawn, the big banana. How did they get there? Where did this trend even start? I'll also chat to a man who I think has the longest work commute in Australia. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, are you a camper? I feel like people fall into one of two camps when asked that question, pardon the pun. You either love it, or the idea of an inflatable mattress and a drop toilet triggers some kind of trauma response. Well, a lot of us spend New Year in a tent or around a fire, but right now there's quite a few unhappy campers in New South Wales. There's a review underway looking at changing the national park's booking system, in some instances making it a lot more expensive to pitch a tent. One campsite on the Hawkesbury, for example, currently costs just over $24 a night, but will increase to $89 a night in peak season, which is really getting up there when you've got to bring your own accommodation with you. The government says it's about fairness and managing demand, but others worry it's pricing people out of nature. At a time when camping is one of the last affordable ways for a family to take a holiday. In just a moment, you'll hear a breakdown of these proposed changes. We'll look at what's happening in other states and ask some of the bigger questions about why access to national parks is so important. With me is Mike Atkinson, known to many as Outback Mike. He's an adventurer and a filmmaker and a familiar face to anyone who watched season one of Alone Australia, where he was runner-up. Mike, welcome to Life Matters.
G'day, thanks for having me.
So this consultation paper, Improving Camping in New South Wales National Parks, when you first had a look at it, you thought it made sense, but you've had a bit of a deeper dive and you're not so happy. What changed for you?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say it made sense, but I didn't see anything alarming. But when you understand that they're going to apply a tier system to approximately 60% of campgrounds, which, as far as I'm aware, never in the history of New South Wales National Parks had a camping fee, that's not obvious when you read this proposal. And if you, the heading of the proposal itself, improving camping, well, for most people, that's not an improvement.
You took a phone call from the New South Wales Environment Minister, Penny Sharp. How'd that conversation go?
Yeah, I was very grateful that she called, and she, she certainly listened to the points that I raised, like that first one about it used to be free for so many places. She also listened to my second point, which was national parks need to increase the amount of campgrounds available to meet demand. She emphasised that it's still in the consultation phase and that this proposal is to seek feedback from the public, and she's not going to make any snap decisions, which is good. I am worried that, historically government can sound like they're listening to things and then time passes, the spotlight goes off, and then it just gets snuck through. I'm concerned that can happen, obviously, in any situation where something new is being proposed. And that's why I think it's important for everybody to understand what's happening. And the thing that's not obvious is that for that majority of campgrounds, for the first time ever, there'll be a fee, and I think it's a significant fee.
You will hear from someone from the New South Wales Parks and Wildlife Service in a moment. But, Mike, what problems do you think that this consultation process are aiming to fix?
Well, they're certainly aiming to fix the ghost booking problems, which is a legitimate problem. So before COVID, there were a number of campsites in the busier areas that had a booking system and a camp fee system. That's fine. I remember doing that as a kid. And for those to be classed in a tier system to make it fairer, you know, more equitable from campsite to campsite, like example you talked about, the Hawkesbury, for example, that sounds fine. It is the introduction of the booking system, which came in COVID, for the express purpose of managing an infectious disease. When you apply a booking system to very cheap campgrounds, which was actually a booking fee of $6, which only paid for the website, it didn't contribute to the campsite, you have this ghost booking problem that happens. And people love to blame the ghost bookers. It's a little bit like COVID, where you didn't need, no one was really in need of toilet paper, but if you didn't go out and buy it when it came out, there was this big hot rush to get it. So they're going to solve that ghost booking problem for those 50, 60, 70% of places that never had a fee before by just putting up prices. And that is convenient if you're trying to raise revenue, but it will block out a great number of low-income families, young people. They're not going to pay hundreds of dollars to go camping for a week. So it's just going to block out a lot of people.
On the text line, Josie's texted in saying, national parks need to be protected and respected. In Victoria, recently our government decided there would be no booking fees. You just book online and turn up. This approach has been immensely detrimental to the community. People book a site, may or may not turn up. They don't cancel because there's no money to be returned. The sites are either empty or have been booked by people who want the site next to them as well. Josie says, in the end, I'm happy to pay, but I think there's a sweet spot. Enough of a fee to warrant cancelling your booking to get your money back, but not so low that you're happy to just let it go without a refund. Mike, listening to Josie's obviously in Victoria, not New South Wales, but is there a sweet spot in terms of paying for something to give it a value to people?
Well, I totally agree with her. And there isn't a sweet spot in the middle between the two extremes. It's either free or it's expensive. Both solve the problem. And to go in the middle doesn't really work. And so for Josie, I'm not sure of her economic background and whatever, but she can probably afford, she can probably afford maybe to pay $56 a night in high season to secure that site and have certainty for herself. And I can probably do that too. But there are many people, and when I grew up, there, you know, there wasn't heaps of money floating about. So that would block us out. And so the best thing is to remove it. And if people say, oh, well, you know, how do I know that there's going to be a campsite? That's the way it has been for eternity before COVID came in. And if there is an increasing visitation, then they need to increase the number of sites. That is obviously going to help with demand.
So supply and demand, working on the supply side as well as the demand side.
Absolutely. And in the proposal, they did not consider increasing the amount of campsites. So, of course, they're driving, well, demand is going up and they're keeping supply steady. That's just going to be price increases forever.
Janine's called in from the Central Coast. Janine, you've read the proposal. You see it's got pros and cons.
Yes, I think one of the things that I welcome is that the proposal's actions to sort of reduce ghost booking. So that's where people book, pay, and then don't turn up, but it blocks the site for everyone else. But one of the things that I found very questionable and I disagree with is the fact that they're going to change the per-person booking to a site booking, and they increase the amount, but it really has a negative effect on people that are camping on their own or maybe just with one other person. It makes the cost prohibitive, and I find this really disadvantages women as well. Women, national parks campsites are considered fairly safe for women, and a lot of women camp and travel around Australia on their own, or maybe with one other woman, and they're going to end up with this cost rise. You may be paying, instead of $24 a night or something, you may be paying $65 just because the campsite happens to have a flush toilet. You know, they're going to be ending up on the sides of roads and stuff, and it's just not the experience of the national park and the safety as well. So that's an issue that I think needs to be thought about. Yeah.
Excellent point. Thank you so much, Janine, for calling in. You are listening to Life Matters on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. We're talking about how camping, at least in New South Wales national parks, is looking like the prices are going to jump. There's a consultation paper out at the moment. And I'm also speaking with adventurer and filmmaker Mike Atkinson. Mike, you've been very vocal on this issue. You've got quite a big profile on social media. What kind of things are people telling you about, because I'm guessing the people who follow you are keen campers, keen users of these spaces. What are they telling you about the proposal?
95% of them are in line with what I say. There is 5% that do have conflicting views, but they agree because they are more likely the people who have experienced the problems, and they are also the more likely the people who've had a lifetime of experience in camping. Like, it seems to me when I'm chatting to the people, the decision makers here, they aren't campers. They don't know the history before it was the park, before COVID. So they can't visualise in their mind an idea that you could go camping for free. Because at the moment, there's still that $6 booking fee. So people that really camp a lot understand how bad it is once they realise there's going to be new fees on stuff that never had them. Sorry, can I also add just a point on what Georgia was saying, the previous caller. It will, when it prices people out, and she's talking about security and stuff, you're going to find people, Kosciuszko National Park, for example, people are going to be camping outside the park because it's too expensive. And then you're going to have illegal camping, farmers getting upset, signs placed up in every dead end street saying no camping. And that's going to be just a nasty feeling for the places outside of the national parks.
John says, as a former ranger, park manager and keen camper, I think affordable camp fees are critical to maintaining public support for the parks. They're a natural asset that belongs to us all, not a business. Visiting a national park is not like going to a concert. It's a right, not a privilege. We'll lose the parks if we restrict access to the better off. Kate in Sydney says, I don't mind paying more to access our beautiful national parks if the additional revenue will be used to improve their management. Mike, where's the sweet spot here?
Well, I really like the first point that previous ranger said, and his opinion really adds weight. For some of us, we can afford to pay more, but it comes down to that person that can't afford to pay more. And even though I am someone that can now afford to pay more, there is also a resentment that I have that I should be paying $56, $36 plus my $190 to get into the Kosciuszko National Park, for example. They don't all have fees to get into the parks, but you've got that on top for some parks. There's a resentment that I should be out here enjoying nature, and I'm just sitting here going, this is wrong. It is philosophically wrong. It is a national park. It is a national asset. And to be paying money like it's a concert is it just upsets you just on the inside.
Well, this is a consultation process. It's still open. And earlier I spoke to Georgia Rivers, who's the Director of Visitor Management and Revenue with the New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife Service. And I started by asking her about why they've opened this consultation process.
We're undertaking public consultation in which we're asking campers to let us know how they think campgrounds should be managed and priced across New South Wales. The reason that we're asking this question and asking for this feedback is that fees have been set in quite an ad hoc way across the state over time. And there are various issues with campground management that campers have let us know about after their stays and in various surveys. And so we've put together this paper in which we talk about some of the issues and we put forward some thoughts about things that we think might solve them, and things like pricing that we think might make it a fair and consistent system that everyone can understand. And we're asking for feedback, and we will have a look at all of that feedback and make changes to the proposal accordingly and then work out what we should do.
So this is obviously still in the proposal phase, but there are some that argue that they're already paying for national parks with their taxes, that it should all be free. And in the proposed price structure, places like, for example, the Cat Eye Campground in the Hawkesbury is currently $24.60 per night, will increase to $89 a night in the high season. Given that we are in a cost of living crisis, is this not potentially pricing some people out of campgrounds?
This proposal is actually not about increasing fees. It's about putting a framework that links the price to what you get, so facilities and services and demand, so people know what to expect. in fact, will be lowering prices in many cases, making basic campgrounds free, lowering prices when it's quiet in low season, which is about three quarters of the year, removing extra person fees, booking fees, and so on. In some places, yes, the prices will go up, and that's because we may have upgraded the campground with great facilities, or there's a lot of demand we need to manage, or and costs, of course, have gone up a lot. We maintain about 365 campgrounds across New South Wales, and we absolutely want everyone to be able to go camping. And camping will always remain a low-cost option for people's holiday. As I said, we'll be actually making it cheaper in many cases. It's probably important to realise that the camping fees only cost a very small proportion of what it costs to maintain campgrounds. So they are absolutely subsidised by taxpayers, as you say. And that will continue. We don't expect the fees to cover the costs at all. But we think that it's probably fair that campers chip in a bit when they go camping.
So is part of the restructuring aimed at stopping what's been called ghost camping, where people make a booking but then they never show up?
Yes, that's right. We and other states seem to have a problem with people making bookings and then maybe plans change and they don't show up. Which, of course, is fine, except the problem that we have is that people aren't cancelling. They aren't letting us know that they're not coming, which means that the site isn't freed up for someone else. So what we're proposing here, we've looked at a lot of options, but what we're proposing is that if we put in place reasonable fees, that will make people think twice about making the booking in the first place, but most importantly, we are proposing to increase the amount of refund you get if you cancel in the hope that that will give people an incentive to actually let us know that they're no longer coming, which will free up the camp space for someone else.
So when do you hope to have some results from this consultation period?
Consultation is open until the 25th of May, and then we will analyse all of the feedback that we get and work out what campers think, what they think, how they think we should be managing campgrounds. And then we will update the proposal and give it to the government to make a decision. And if any changes end up being made, I guess it will happen in 2026 sometime.
So that's Georgia Rivers, who's Director of Visitor Engagement and Revenue with the New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife Service. Mike Atkinson, otherwise known as Outback Mike, has been chatting to me about this today. He's got some big thoughts about this process. Mike, what's your main piece of feedback that you'll be submitting as part of this consultation process?
My main two points is that for the places prior to COVID that were free with no booking system, to return it to that way. And the second one is to increase the supply by creating more campsites to match the 49% visitation that they quote in their paper. And I should also just add there that in that consultation process, why me and many other people are a little distrusting, if you look at the terminology, the way it's worded, the fact that they don't highlight anywhere in this document that 50 to 60, 70% of places for the first time ever are going to have a fee, that's a bit of a red flag. And if you look at the way that the survey is written, there's a lot of leading questions like, do you want fairer so-and-so? It's like, it should be asked up to us to decide what's fair, not being told, do you want something to be fairer? Mm. So I don't think the way they're seeking feedback is leading them in a direction that they already want.
This is Life Matters on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, and we're talking about a consultation process currently underway in New South Wales National Parks to look at the way people pay for camping there and book sites. Lots and lots of people texting in about this. One person says, this is a slap in the face for families who love to take their kids camping. Camping's always been the affordable alternative. Now it's becoming out of reach. They went camping in northern New South Wales during the Christmas school holiday period with the kids and grandkids. 7 days, $42 a night. You pay extra for hot showers. The proposed fees would see that rise to $630 per family if the new fees come in. This person says, that's a substantial increase and would prohibit some families from introducing their kids to the wonderful outdoor world of camping. Well, I'd like to bring in Richard Kingsford, who's Associate Professor and Director of the Centre for Ecosystem Science at the University of New South Wales. Richard, welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning, Tegan.
A lot of this conversation is about paying or not paying, how much is worth paying, how much isn't worth paying. And we heard Georgia say before that you're never really paying the cost of staying in the campsite when you're paying a fee. How do we ensure there's enough funding to support our national park system?
Look, I think this is a big challenge, and it's increasingly a challenge, particularly as populations increase and more people want to enjoy, you know, nature and go to our national parks. And then there's, you know, how do you cope with that demand in such a way that's fair and you give everybody a chance to experience what wonderful places these are? But clearly, there are some challenges in terms of if the fees are too low, people are doing these ghost bookings, which is, I think, really problematic. And I think governments around the world, not just in Australia, have to deal with this issue of supply and demand and the tension there about, well, do we just keep increasing facilities at the cost of the national park? And then how do we get some sort of cost recovery here, given that, you know, these are really big places to manage and there's the funding sources are not great in terms of being able to bring them to get the best out of them.
There's some really interesting texts on the text line that I'd like to put to you, Richard. Is a fair amount to be charging to park to camp in a national park? But Richard, one person says, how much should we increase access to camping? We have to think about the pressure on the environment as the population grows and maybe limit numbers camping. Another text from David Stead from the National Parks Association in Sydney saying national parks are created to protect nature, not to be cut down for pseudo accommodation, not to meet supply and demand. Richard, how do we balance our desire to go and experience nature with the actual conservation, which is what parks are for?
Yeah, look, it's really difficult. And inevitably, if you open up parks completely for tourism, you're going to impact on the conservation objectives for that national park. So And all around the world, places that have very high visitor demand in North America and in Africa, people are highly regulated. They actually have to pay a lot of money. They can only go to certain parts of a park. And I think inevitably, if we try and look at our parks in 20 years' time, and people are trying to get as much out of them as possible, we'll need to regulate more. And so people will be restricted in when they can go to some places, and we'll have to have booking. And that booking will need to make sure that, you know, this problem of ghost bookings goes away. I think that the issue that also, particularly in Africa, where you've got high-end tourism and locals that can't afford to go into parks, they have a different type of tier system that may be useful in this space. But there's that tension between not wanting to develop a national park more so you're impacting on nature, but also providing enough for visitors to experience the splendour of those national parks.
Why is access to national parks by humans so important? Because you could make the case that it should be for conservation and no one should be allowed to go there, but we do get so much out of being able to visit them.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, quite apart from anything else, people vote. And, you know, the environment's really important in terms of our government decision making. And the more we can convince people that these are so important to our livelihoods and the planet's livelihoods, the better. And there's no better way of doing that than going into a national park and experiencing what goes on in terms of, you know, the wonderful landscapes, the animals and the plants and nature in its full glory. But we also know that after COVID, that so many people actually needed green spaces for their mental well-being. And more we're understanding that these are the places that give us, the things that we need to make meaningful what we're doing in life. So, you know, we do need to look after not just ourselves in the future, but we need to look after all the other plants and animals that actually share this planet with us.
Yeah, that real sense of perspective that you get when you're able to go out into a natural environment. But even from an economic and cultural point of view, national parks are really important to the communities around them.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, I think people sometimes forget how important our national parks are economically. I mean, we know that a lot of tourism is actually going to find nature, you know, people, and along the way, they're willing to pay a lot of money, even going to towns on the way, say, to the outback. You're going to be spending your dollar in towns and accommodation. And then when you actually get there, and not to mention all the fuel that you paid to get out there, it is a big tourism opportunity. And I think even in a much wider expanse, if you look at what's happening in the middle of the continent now with the Lake Eyre Basin, that's going to result in a huge boon in terms of people visiting places like Coongi Lakes National Park, which is out near Innamincka, because of this amazing wildlife that will happen out there. So it is an important part of the economic equation as well. And I think one of the big challenges for governments is that there's this issue of cost recovery, and when there are a lot of other demands on state and federal budgets, how do you make sure you've got enough money not only to buy the national park but to manage it appropriately? And that means dealing with invasive species, issues to do with a whole range of conservation of threatened species. But then on top of that, you've got to manage the people pressure that's going to come with people visiting.
Richard, thank you so much. Richard Kingsford is with the University of New South Wales. Mike Atkinson, aka Outback Mike, is a filmmaker and adventurer. George Rivers is the Director of Visitor Engagement and Revenue in New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife Service. So we first ran this story in May. I'm told by Mike that a decision still hasn't been made and the fee changes are still up in the air. Well, next up here on Life Matters, it's all about the big things. A big banana, a big prawn, and a push for the next big thing.
Christopher Skase was charming,
audacious,
powerfully charismatic.
Christopher Skase had it all. A beautiful wife, great hair, and a $1 billion empire. It's almost as if it was...
too good to be true.
Too good to be true.
Well, it was.
The largest corporate collapse in Australian history.
I'm Mark Humphreys. To binge the full series now, search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
As a kid, every second year or so, we would make the 20-ish hour drive from Brisbane to Melbourne to visit family. This was in the days before climate-controlled SUVs, where you were three sweaty kids wedged along a back seat and you had maybe four tapes that would cycle through the tape deck. This is the reason why I know all of the words to Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. One of the bright spots of those long hours were the big things. First, there was the prawn at Ballina. Then there was the golden guitar at Tamworth. By the time we got to Ned Kelly and Glen Rowan, we knew we were basically home and hosed. I think I'd thought of these big things as kitschy throwbacks, but in recent months, there has been talk of building a giant pear three stories high in Shepparton, Victoria. So what is the deal with Australia's obsession with big things? Some people love them. Some people think they're tacky. Do they actually make a difference to the towns they're in? Well, Sarah Tate is big thing royalty. Her family owned the Big Potato in New South Wales. And Claire McCracken is from the School of Art at RMIT University. Claire's research focuses on art in public spaces. Claire, you are studying this, but you also have experience here. There was a push for a big attraction in your town.
Yes, yeah. Thanks for having me. I grew up in a small town called Myrtleford in Victoria, which is one of the many gateways to Australia's snowfields. And in the early 1980s, to put that township on the map and get cars that were passing through to the ski fields to pause and stop and spend money, there was a proposal to build a 17-metre giant snowman. And my father noted that this giant snowman would actually block the town's vision of Mount Buffalo, one of the great mountains of Australia. And so he contested the construction of that snowman, which turned into quite an ordeal. Passions were raised. We got threatening phone calls. It ended up down in the court system in Melbourne. Dad ultimately won just as I started primary school. And so my first nickname was Snowman Killer.
Oh my gosh, what an entree to the world of bullying, and I'm sorry that happened to you. What was your dad's objection, apart from the Mount Buffalo thing? Did he think it was tacky? Was your dad too classy for a snowman?
Well, he looked into the kind of business cases of big things and noticed that they weren't always successful. But he wins the case on the grounds that it would block what was actually the true tourist attraction of the township, which is this really beautiful mountain.
I love that you're following in your dad's footsteps by researching, like really looking at the numbers behind big things and whether they're successful or not. What do you think about Shepparton's idea of building the big pear?
Well, I think there's real merit in the idea because it's not just a big pear, it's also a museum that will be talking about the agricultural history of the region with a focus on the role that migrants have played in that. And there's significant merit in doing that. That's fantastic, particularly at this time. And of course, migrants continue to shape regional Australian and agriculture. Whether it has to be in the shape of a big pear is the ultimate question. And of course, really great architecture that's designed sensibly and heightens our attunement to our beautiful ecology and landscape can also be a really great way to stop a passing car in awe.
You are listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Claire McCracken, who's at RMIT University looking at art in public spaces. We're talking about big stuff, like literal big things on the sides of highways. I have a soft spot for the big prawn at Ballina. Tony says, I was gobsmacked the first time I drove past the big merino in Goulburn about 40 years ago. Ungerry in central west New South Wales, says another person, features a massive 800-kilogram fiberglass football, making it a notable attraction and symbol of the town's connection to the AFL. Clint says, I used to have a book as a kid in the 80s called It Really Is a Big Country that had all the big things in it. The more fiberglass monstrosities, the better, I say. Clint, well, Clint, I hope the potato was in your book because I'm joined by Sarah Tate, whose family owned the big potato. Sarah, you were born in the home of the big potato, but your family didn't own it yet.
That's right. Hi, Tegan. I was born in Robertson and my parents actually had the local pub at the time. So I grew up in a town of maybe 1,000 people where the kind of biggest and most exciting thing was the big potato that we would walk past every day on the way to school. So I didn't become royalty until my 20s and have already abdicated. So it's been a real journey for our family with the big potato.
Talk to me about the acquisition of the potato, please.
So my parents had a little supermarket on the land that adjoined next to the big potato. And there was a bit of a skirmish, really, where there was it was a land grab, really. There was talk of someone buying that land and knocking down the big potato to put up a parking lot. Well, put down a parking lot for a business that was going to be next door. And my parents bought it at that point. And then it kind of became absorbed as part of their larger business. And they, you know, made it a little park, put up tables and flowers and things like that. So then it really firmly became part of the Tate family identity, which it always felt right considering our surname, you know?
Fair. So there's a text here, someone saying the big merino in Goulburn is great. And then they say the big potato in Robertson sometimes steamed in the early morning, which prompted a local nickname. But the text doesn't tell me what the nickname is. Is it fit for radio?
I mean, it is. If one has cheap humour, I think people would call it the big T-U-R-D because it's true, it did steam in the morning because it's a beautiful foggy town. But my family have always, even before we had any real like proprietary connection to it, we just kind of thought that those jokes were cheap. I don't know why. There was just something like that bristled on the back of my neck.
Protect in the potato. To
I know. Isn't it wonderful?
Claire, I want to know sort of how unique this obsession with big tourist attractions is. It's not just an Australian thing, is it?
No, you find big things globally, although they do particularly proliferate in the United States, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and South Africa. But what is unique is our name, Big Things, which you get in New Zealand as well. So
they call them bug things.
So big things, bug things, good point. Big things mean both huge buildings that you can enter, but also sculptures that are very large that you might drive past, like your prawn.
Why?
Well, they grow out of the post-Second World War changes to economics in country towns. So country towns really have to diversify. They have to find ways to pull in tourists. And you also get the uptake of motor vehicles and the start of driving tourism. And so their response to the vision through the windscreen, an architectural response to the vision through the windscreen, and they're literally designed to stop passing cars in awe, get people to stop their car and take a photo. So the technology of the camera is also really important to their evolution. And as they, as the road network proliferates, they expand, and as domestic tourism grows, particularly in the 80s and 90s, we see a huge proliferation of them. And it's interesting, the contemporary ones quite often are a bit smaller, and I think that's often a response to the mobile phone and the selfie, because if you try and get the huge merino in a selfie, it's virtually impossible. But the big bogan in Ningen, quite easy to get in the selfie framing. So, yeah, a result of the motor vehicle, but also the development of the camera.
I've got I'm Googling the big bogan as we speak because I've never seen it before. Oh, it's just like a guy and a dog. Echoing what you're just saying there, Claire, one person says, my favourite big things are the ones that are sort of not quite big enough, just kind of like medium things, which people have obviously thought were a really good idea, and going ahead they sort of just degrade in the weather and look a bit terrible and sad. I wonder why that's so attractive to you, Texter. If you've got a follow-up sort of, I wonder if there's a sort of, I don't know, ennui or nihilism sort of vibe coming through there. I personally love the moderately sized avocado in the Northern Rivers in New South Wales. Another person says, the big pineapple was a wonderful experience as children, going on the little green train through the beautiful glowing fields of pineapples, eating pineapples and ginger, and going to the nearby sugar-growing plantations and factories too. Brian from Brisbane also loved the big pineapple at Nambour. Always knew we were on the Sunshine Coast. Also went there on a primary school excursion. I'm now 60 years old. So, Sarah, I've got to know, obviously you have a loyalty to the potato that runs deep in your blood, but are there any other big things that you favour?
I really love the big merino as well. I think that it's a beautifully executed big thing. But I also have a soft spot for the medium-sized decaying big things, the medium things. I think what I really love about them is that it shows that we're a country of dreamers. You know, people really intend for these things to be something special. It's a place where families can kind of stop and have these photos that go in photo albums if they still print photos. I'm also kind of fond of that big bogan in Ningen for the same reason. They're all these little markers that show like you're progressing through your journey. You're on the way. You're getting closer. You're seeing all these things that let you know that you're reaching your destination. There's not one that I don't love. I don't know if I have always been warm toward them because of where I grew up, but I just think that they show such aspiration, even if they're not perfectly executed.
Claire, I love that line that Sarah just said about it shows that we're a nation of dreamers. How does that fit with your work?
It does. I agree. There's often an entrepreneurial and aspirational desire with big things. And a lot of them are, you know, a single farmer with a dream to stop a car, although there are also ones like the Big Bogan that have been supported by local government. But of course, the really big objects we build in space do come to define regional Australia. And so I have also critiqued the way in which they might signal one history over another or one way of being. And it is, for example, very noticeable that all of the big things we've built, and even if they're not anatomically masculine, like the big ram, or the big merino, are male. And so you start to signal the kind of masculine over the feminine regional Australia. And those people in regional Australia know that the outmigration, particularly of women, is quite significant. So while I think they do demonstrate a kind of dreamer and an entrepreneurial attitude and a way of making things happen and keeping your town on the map, when you blow something up big, it also starts to signify things, and it starts to kind of signify one history over multiple histories. So that's where we can start to get into a tangle.
I've never looked at the prawn that closely. So with the age of selfies, I was struck before when you said the thing about the kind of combined technologies of cars, highways and cameras in the sort of mid-20th century as sort of supercharging this big thing. But now we're obsessed with taking photos all the time. We're obsessed with social media. You mentioned selfies before. Do you think that there's going to be like another golden age of big things because we're taking photos on the road all the time?
Yes, and I think they've also benefited of the increase in cost of international travel post-COVID. So we are hitting the roads again, and we're hitting the roads locally. And if you look at where they're being constructed, it's short distances from major metropolitan centres, you know, Shepparton, 2.5 hours from Melbourne. So when you map them, when you put the dots down, there are notable exceptions and some in very remote areas, but they tend to proliferate where urban dwellers might do day trips or 3-day trips.
Thank you so much, Sarah and Claire. Sarah Tate's family owned the Big Potato in New South Wales, and Claire McCracken is from the School of Art at RMIT University. Well, stick with me, because next up on Life Matters, meet the man who I think has the longest work commute in the country.
She was every student's favourite teacher.
She would joke around with us, more like a friend than a teacher.
And I remember her saying to me that this is not goodbye, this is see you later kind of thing.
Well, if Ali is able to open up to somebody, that's a good thing.
But what began as a tension became something else.
She was brainwashing us from the start.
The Favourite, a 5-part investigation into the cost of silence. Available now. Search Background Briefing on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Earlier this year on Life Matters, we talked about your commute and I issued a call out for the longest commute. Well, I think I've just found a very strong contender. Imagine your work means you have to live on a tiny remote island. The only access is a 3-day sailing journey from Hobart. No aeroplanes, no helicopters. As part of our series on Your Weirdest Day at Work, marine ecologist Ben Arthur is sharing his experience of working on Macquarie Island, a tiny speck of land between Tasmania and Antarctica, where elephant seals, king penguins and albatross far outnumber the human population. And despite its remote location, the island has global conservation significance and inspired Ben to start a conservation foundation. Ben, welcome.
G'day, Tegan.
You're not on Macquarie Island right now.
No, unfortunately not. It's actually a great time to be on Macquarie Island, though, the kind of tail end of summer. So, you know, peak breeding season would have happened a couple of months ago down there. So, you know, all of those kind of cute and cuddly pups and chicks and so on are starting to grow up now. But unfortunately, I'm talking to you from Hobart, which is, you know, it's still pretty cool, but not as cool as Macquarie Island.
Unfortunately, I'm in Hobart. What does an average day look like for you when you are on Macquarie Island?
I think it really depends on what part of the island you're on. So the island is very long and skinny. So it's about 35 k's long, 5 k's wide at its widest point. And right at the very northern tip is a research station that's run by the Australian Antarctic Division. And in summer, there's around 30 or so people that are there, a kind of mixture of station support and technical staff and also researchers and scientists. So if you're based on station, I guess it's relatively comfortable because you know, you've got your own bedroom and you've got a cook and a chef who cooks breakfast and lunch and dinner for you. You know, you've got all of the kind of support and you've got laboratories there. If you're out in the field further down island, you're often based in a little hut. And your day, typically as a researcher, would be walking around the island because there is no road on the island. There's no footpaths, there's no infrastructure. So the only way to get around is your legs. So you're often out and about in fairly wild conditions, moving from place to place.
You had to learn to walk differently on Macquarie Island.
Oh, totally, you're right, because you know it's wild, it's windy. So, you know, I'm talking to you from Hobart. Most people, your listeners, think about Hobart as probably having some of the wildest weather in Australia. It's wet, it's windy, all the weather comes from the west. Macquarie Island is like Tassie, but on steroids as far as the weather's concerned. So everything's windier, everything's wetter, everything's wilder. So when you're walking around, not only are you being mindful about where you put your feet because it's very muddy, you've got delicate plants, you've also got large things you want to avoid like elephant seals and penguins, you're taking into account the wind. And, you know, a standard day on the island is probably, you know, 30 knots of wind, 20, 30 knots of wind on a good day. On a bad day, it might be 50, 60 and upwards of there. So when you're walking around with a pack on, it's pretty easy to get knocked off your feet.
You've become a sail, like your whole body. You had a pretty wild day at, you call the research huts googies. Tell me about this crazy day that you had out there.
Yeah. So a googie hut is, if anyone's seen them, they're those kind of round ones that sit up on stilts. They almost look like little Smarties or little spaceships up on stilts. And I remember being about two-thirds of the way down the island, so about a day and a half walk from station. And I was there on my own. I was doing a round island trip looking for elephant seals to kind of re-sight elephant seals that we'd known about in the past. They'd been marked with little tags. So we were looking to see, I guess, who was still in the population, who was breeding. And overnight, it got quite windy in that hut. And those huts, because they sit up on stilts, they actually wobble around in the breeze a bit, which is a little bit disconcerting because you're really hoping that the, you know, I guess that the builder that put that thing together 30 years ago really did tighten up the nuts properly. Because otherwise you'd disappear onto the Southern Ocean and probably never be seen again. So I remember they're kind of lying there and, you know, the hut's wobbling around and you could hear the, you know, the cups that are on the kind of hooks on the shelf kind of clinking against each other. And I had to get up the next morning and I was supposed to walk to the very southern tip of the island to a place called Heard Point. And on Macquarie Island, most of the walking is actually done up on the plateau. So you have to kind of leave the hut, climb up those steep coastal slopes, normally a couple of hundred metres in altitude, get up onto the plateau and walk down there. And I left the hut knowing it was a bit windy and it was there was snow on the ground and it was kind of pretty wild. You could look out to the Southern Ocean. There were sea spray being whipped up and little kind of mini tornadoes of water out there. And I kind of made my way along the coast for a little bit and then up onto the plateau. And I got physically knocked off my feet, I think, half a dozen times. You know, I'm a pretty skinny chap and I didn't weigh a lot in that particular day. I think I was around 60 kilos. So it was pretty easy to get knocked around. And I got up to the track junction up on the plateau. And the only way I could physically stand up was by holding onto a rock, basically hug a clump of rocks that was there. The wind was that fierce from the west. And I kind of thought to myself, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to make it the next kind of 3 or 4 hours walk to the next hut that I need to. You know, and I think at the time maybe 22 or 23, so I was kind of keen to get there, right? You don't want to be beaten by the weather. So I kind of let go of the rock and tried and then got knocked over again. I thought, no, this is a bad idea. So I kind of retreated back down to the hut and I opened the door and each of the huts has obviously got a radio in it so you can keep in contact with people. And the station leader was kind of frantically calling me on the radio, ordering me to stay in the hut because he was sitting at the weather station down at the main base and the wind was gusting to 110 knots at sea level, which is, you know, 200 something k's an hour. And he was worried that I was physically just going to get plucked off the island and never be seen again. So I got my order to stay in the hut, which was kind of nice because I did. And I got to stay there for the day and, you know, drink cups of tea. And there was one little elephant seal who sheltered in the kind of porch of the door there to get out of the wind and the rain and the snow. And we spent a fairly relaxing day, you know, entering some data into a notebook and just watching the wild weather.
See, that's the part of the job that sounds appealing to me, not so much the clinging to a rock, thinking you're going to get swept into the Southern Ocean. So, Ben, you've also been to Antarctica. How does the conditions compare between the two?
Yeah, it's interesting. So, I mean, Antarctica is obviously, you know, it's colder, it's drier, it can get pretty fierce, but you normally get periods of stable weather for quite long periods of time. The thing about Macquarie Island is it's this relatively small speck of rock in the middle of the Southern Ocean. So, you know, talking to you from Hobart, we're in the roaring 40s. Macquarie Island's in the furious 50s, so 54 degrees south. And if you look at a map of the world, there is really nothing in that band of latitude, apart from a couple of sub-Antarctic islands. So what that means is, you know, all the weather comes from the west and it just builds up and builds up and builds up. Those low-pressure systems just kind of barrel through, you know, a couple of days, you know, they come through pretty quickly. So it's actually, in a way, probably got fiercer weather, more challenging weather, because you very rarely get stable weather. You know, the number of days in a 6 month period over summer where you could go outside and go, there's no wind, is probably two or three in 6 months. So it is really wild, but that's part of the appeal of the place, is you really have to earn it to get there.
Tell me about the Macquarie Island Conservation Foundation.
Yeah, so this was set up a couple of years ago, four of us who had spent time on the island, so a mix of researchers and park rangers. And, you know, we'd been there and we'd seen often you will struggle to get funding and support to do some of those really critical long-term things like monitoring projects and so on that we need to know, so we can, you know, look at how animal populations might be changing or plants and those kind of things. And at the same time, there's actually a very nicely regulated and very controlled tourism industry on Macquarie Island. So every summer in about December or January, a small number of expedition tourist vessels are permitted to turn up there. And, you know, it's a nature reserve, so everyone's name has to be on a permit and you have to be guided by people on the island. So we would guide these tourists around the kind of two spots that they were able to go. And, you know, they'd have this most amazing day. They'd be walking alongside king penguins and have wandering albatross and albatross flying overhead and elephant seals, you know, giving birth on the beach, all that kind of amazing stuff. And they kind of turned to you and go, well, how can we help? You know, and we were down there, you know, representing a state government agency, which you can't donate to. The federal government agency runs the research station, which you couldn't donate to. So there was no real kind of avenue for it. So, you know, several years later, when, as all good ideas, when you're catching up for a beer at the pub, you kind of think, well, we should set up a conservation foundation. Someone should set up a conservation foundation. Maybe it should be us. How hard can it be? And it turns out it's quite hard. it takes a bit of work to get something like that off the ground. And now what we have is the Macquarie Island Conservation Foundation. So we are that, I guess, matchmaker, that kind of middle ground between tapping into donations and philanthropy to support research and conservation work on the island.
When are you heading back down South, Ben?
So I'll be going down January. So our foundation, we are lucky. We have the support and we partner with a number of those expedition tourism companies. So the voyages that go to Macquarie Island, we're able to send representatives on board. So our role there is to really impress upon the guests the importance of Macquarie Island. It's a World Heritage Area. It is a thoroughly unique environment from an Australian point of view and also a global point of view.
That was marine ecologist Ben Arthur, who spends much of his time on a tiny island between Tasmania and Antarctica. And if you missed it earlier, have you noticed how expensive camping's become? Here's Outback adventurer Mike Atkinson's take.
Before COVID, there were a number of campsites in the busier areas that had a booking system and a camp fee system. That's fine. I remember doing that as a kid. And for those to be classed in a tier system to make it fairer, you know, more equitable from campsite to campsite, like example you talked about the Hawkesbury, for example, that sounds fine. It is the introduction of the booking system, which came in COVID, for the express purpose of managing an infectious disease. When you apply a booking system to very cheap campgrounds, which was actually a booking fee of $6, which only paid for the website, it didn't contribute to the campsite, you have this ghost booking problem that happens. And people love to blame the ghost bookers. It's a little bit like COVID, where no one was really in need of toilet paper, but if you didn't go out and buy it when it came out, there was this big hot rush to get it. So they're going to solve that ghost booking problem for those 50, 60, 70% of places that never had a fee before by just putting up prices. And that is convenient if you're trying to raise revenue, but it will block out a great number of low-income families, young people. They're not going to pay hundreds of dollars to go camping for a week. So it's just going to block out a lot of people. And if people say, oh, well, you know, how do I know that there's going to be a campsite? That's the way it has been for eternity before COVID came in. And if there is an increasing visitation, then they need to increase the number of sites. That is obviously going to help with demand. Like, it seems to me when I'm chatting to the people, the decision makers here, they aren't campers. They don't know the history before it was the park, before COVID. So they can't visualise in their mind an idea that you could go camping for free, because at the moment there's that still that $6 booking fee. So people that really camp a lot understand how bad it is once they realise there's going to be new fees on stuff that never had them. It will, when it prices people out, you're going to find people, Kosciuszko National Park, for example, people are going to be camping outside the park because it's too expensive. And then you're going to have illegal camping, farmers getting upset, signs placed up in every dead-end street saying no camping. And that's going to be just a nasty feeling for the places outside of the national parks.
Well, that is it for Life Matters today, coming to you from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Today's show was all about travel, something very applicable to many of us right now. Tomorrow, we'll dive into our mental health, how to be happy and stay happy. From all the team at Life Matters, I hope you have a safe and relaxing New Year's. You can catch up on any of our stories today on the ABC Listen app, and I'll see you again tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.